You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
New Yorkers have a reputation for being tolerant and liberal, but is that really true? Well, in his new book, City of Disorder, Alex S. Vitale points out that before the current economic crunch and even before Republican mayors came to dominate City Hall, New York City was more likely to use tax dollars to subsidize market-rate housing and high-rise office buildings for the wealthy than to build affordable housing for the poor. His book is published by the NYU Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Alex S. Vitale to the show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
You've pointed out that even the city's liberal mayors, including John Lindsay, Abe Beame, Ed Koch, David Dinkins, created policies and agreed to projects that resulted in gentrification and displacement to poor residents. Didn't those policies usually include offering tax incentives or abatements to developers?
Yes. The city has spent billions of dollars just in the last 30 years or so to subsidize market rate housing and corporate office space development. You know, even in times when the economy was booming, for instance, during the Koch administration, they subsidized tens of millions of square feet of office space development, but by midterm of the Dinkins administration, almost all that space was empty. So this has contributed to a kind of boom and bust cycle that has destabilized neighborhoods and the overall city's economy.
How are they able to do that with the zoning laws that are in place?
Well, the zoning laws are flexible. You know, it's not that hard for developers to come in and argue for changes in the zoning laws. And in much of the city, there's already a lot of right to build that isn't fully utilized.
Well, we'll get into whether gentrification is a good or bad thing, but can you explain for us how the process by which the construction of an upscale office or apartment building in a moderate or low-income neighborhood snowballs into gentrification?
Well, the big problem, you know, for these subsidies wasn't so much in the outer boroughs, it was in Manhattan. And a lot of what I try to talk about in the book is the way in which these subsidies contributed and exacerbated the homelessness problem. So the real brunt of this, the use of 421A and J51 subsidies, was about the elimination of SRO housing, which had been the housing of last resort for the really poor. And so, especially during the Koch administration, this resulted in the loss of over 100,000 units of very low-income housing. Now, out in the neighborhoods, these subsidies have been used more recently, in particular, to encourage the development of new, higher-density buildings at market rates, generally. Some new legislation has been put in place that's required some affordability to be attached to this, but not always on-site. But the process of gentrification is never just about putting in one building. It's about a process of disinvestment and then reinvestment, and the subsidies tend to get used in certain neighborhoods as part of this overall process.
The reason I said gentrification is a controversial issue is that if you ask the people in some areas that have been gentrified, Red Hook is going through it now, Fort Greene, parts of Harlem, they're very happy to see the change. South Bronx?
Well, it's a mixed bag. I live in Fort Greene, and our local state assembly member, Hakeem Jeffries, has been one of the people who's been at the forefront of challenging some of these subsidies, especially to the extent that the state government is involved. He's trying to sort of moderate gentrification so that the people who've stuck it out in these neighborhoods through the bad years or through the not-so-great years have a chance to benefit from the new amenities.
Part of the problem with the Atlantic Yards for some people is not that it's going to cause gentrification, but that it's going to just change the whole nature of the borough. But that most of these projects are not that big. One of the things that has come out of them is that local factories and businesses have been pushed out of some of these areas.
Yes.
Has that been city policy?
It has been city policy for over a generation. Basically, the city made some decisions in the 60s and 70s to embark on what some people call a kind of global cities model of development, which says that the city's long-term economic future is in high finance and corporate headquarters, communication, culture, that sort of thing, and that New York is not able to compete globally on the manufacturing front, which was prescient in some ways. The flip side of that is that those industries that we've been subsidizing and encouraging have an extremely polarizing effect on the labor market. So what you get is a fairly small number of extremely well-paying jobs and then a huge service class, and it really is a hollowing out of the middle class.
And that service class in the past would have been part of a more complicated mixed economy. They might have worked at a local office. They might have worked at a factory.
Well, see, we don't factory work we don't consider to be service work. The fact is that in the 1940s and 50s, when manufacturing was a major part of the economy, factory jobs were middle class, decent paying, unionized jobs that a person, and this is really important, that a person with limited educational advancement could obtain, so that it was an avenue for a kind of middle class stability for those with just a high school degree.
As I understand it, John Lindsay had planned to relocate many of the businesses that were displaced when the financial district was enlarged and the World Trade Center and Battery Park City were created to the outer boroughs, but he was forced to abandon the plan during the fiscal crisis of the 1970s.
Well, it was more than that. I mean, the outer boroughs weren't always well set up for some of these businesses because of the movement of people and goods. And also there were larger economic changes going on that made it hard to compete for certain types of industries. I do think there's a place in New York for a certain kind of manufacturing, and we certainly need to find some kind of economic niche for those folks who are not going to be in high finance and banking and real estate. And
but the Koch administration had a different idea about that.
Yes,
they actually created a bunch of tax incentives to help push manufacturing out of the city, especially out of Manhattan, but out of the city in general.
Absolutely, absolutely. There was a real decision that this was not the way to go forward, and they didn't just let the market play itself out. They actually accelerated this process. And I think that's one of the points I try to make in the book is that globalization was happening. There were going to be pressures on manufacturing, but the role of the city could have been to moderate these effects instead of accelerating them.
But weren't they also accelerating them when the demand for these new spaces was sluggish?
You know, the World Trade Center was never fully utilized. The only way that they got anywhere close to that was by having huge numbers of government agencies renting the office space at very high commercial rents. So it was the whole thing was an excess, and I'm concerned that the new plans are also an excess.
Is it fair to say that most politicians, even the most liberal among them, have tended to favor real estate developers?
Well, it's true that real estate developers whose wealth is tied to the city in a way that, let's say, corporate leaders or manufacturing leaders, they have more flexibility. They move around. And so they have historically been a major force in influencing politics in the city. They're consistently the biggest givers to politicians in elections.
So cynically, they are going to contribute to my campaign. I'm going to help them out.
Well, they have access. They have influence. They're there from year to year. They're consistent players. And you know, they do have a vested interest in what happens in the city. They have a legitimate need to be involved in politics, but I think that their influence has been disproportionate and has had a negative effect.
My guest is Alex S. Vitale, Associate Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College. He's written a book called City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York's Politics, and it's published by NYU Press. You've said that the Koch and Dinkins administrations spent some $2.3 billion to subsidize market-rate housing and that the incentives that they created contributed to the city losing 10,000 SRO units during the 70s and 80s.
100,000.
Well, 100,000.
Yeah.
Now, there are people who would say, great, those SROs were a blight on the Upper West Side, for example.
You know, the SRO picture is a complicated one because the living standards in those SROs was very poor. And initially, there was some support from nonprofits and advocates for the poor for getting rid of those SROs. But that only makes sense if you're able to replace that with some other kind of viable low-cost housing. And what we had was a kind of double whammy. At exactly the period that we're driving down the bottom of the labor force in terms of wages, during the 90s, average family median wages dropped in every borough except Manhattan, and they dropped especially strongly at the bottom. So at the same time that people's ability to obtain housing is declining, we're wiping out the supply of very low-cost housing.
And we were giving tax breaks to the developers who were doing
that. We were encouraging it. It's one thing that if the market were doing that, we could have instead have spent those billions of dollars trying to create some affordable and supportive housing.
It's also been suggested, or I remember at the time, that some of those SROs were allowed to deteriorate so that they'd become eyesores and people would want to see some kind of change.
That can certainly happen. I mean, that's part of the process of gentrification more broadly.
On the other hand, wasn't the public very concerned that so many of those SROs had become riddled with crime and illegal drug activity?
You know, that's always the problem when you have a poorly funded, poorly regulated mechanism for dealing with people, a population that is going to have a high preponderance of personal and social problems. So was the solution to make those people homeless? I don't think so, because that just created more problems for these middle-class communities. I think, if the Larry Hogues, who terrorized the Upper West Side for so many years, had been in some adequate supported housing, he wouldn't have been such a burden on the residents there.
My guest is Alex S. Vitale, his book, City of Disorder, from NYU Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Alex S. Vitale, an associate professor of sociology at Brooklyn College, and the author of a book called City of Disorder, which is published by New York University Press. Your subtitle is How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics. Isn't that phrase something we usually associate with the Giuliani administration?
Yeah, that's in many ways the primary mission of the book, is to try to explain why a city that is reputedly 80% Democratic in terms of voter registration has voted for Republicans in the last four mayoral elections.
And do you come to a good conclusion?
Well, I think the problem lies in exactly some of the things we were just talking about, a series of sort of fundamental contradictions in the way that previous liberal administrations ran the city.
But you also point out that quality of life didn't begin with the Giuliani administration, although when he was elected in 1993, quality of life had come to mean protecting the business community and the middle class from the city's homeless people. You've traced the evolution of the phrase all the way back to Lyndon Johnson?
Yes. Originally, the term quality of life had a very progressive connotation. During the war on poverty years, the Johnson administration used this as an indicator of the need to improve the quality of life of those who've been left out.
So the quality of poor people's lives.
Yeah, that was primarily the emphasis. If you look at the documents that were involved with the funding of HUD and some other of these war on poverty efforts, the term quality of life is used to indicate the need to improve things for the poor and disenfranchised.
And then during the Nixon years, quality of life had come to mean environmental issues like smog and pollution.
Yeah, it was an ingenious transformation. Nixon was trying to figure out how to get out of this war on poverty. He had very little base in the cities and was working against a lot of the social movements in the cities. And he's like, we need to start reframing the common good, not in terms of bringing up the bottom, but in protecting the middle class.
And then during the Koch years, quality of life came to refer to daily problems of crime and transportation.
And filth and disorder and aggressive panhandling and all of that, which were major problems in the city.
Picked up by the Giuliani administration.
Yeah, interestingly, not in his first run for mayor. It was only after he fell in with the Manhattan Institute, after first losing to Dinkins, that he began to come to terms with this concept and start to marshal it.
Well, haven't many of the things that he's been credited with, didn't many of them begin during the Dinkins years, instituted by Dinkins administration and the MTA?
Well, you know, in many ways, Dinkins has been held up as the paradigm of a liberal mayor who, you know, wasn't able to deliver. But if you look especially at the latter years of his administration, he not only pursued these same sort of conservative economic policies, but he also adopted many of the kind of more punitive law and order approaches. So many people credit Giuliani with getting rid of the squeegee men, but in fact, most of that had been addressed under the Dinkins administration.
And the Dinkins administration had adopted the broken window style of policing because—
In places.
Well, George Kelling actually mm-hmm. had— who was one of the people who came up with that, James Wilson, the other, Kelling had worked for the MTA.
Well, that wasn't a mayoral appointment. The MTA is a state agency. So the broken window stuff was happening in the subways, and Dinkins did bring Kelling in to do some consulting about the squeegee problem and a few other things. But it was still just an experiment and somewhat driven by internal dynamics within the police department and also pressure in local neighborhoods. Dinkins wasn't able to come to grips with this transformation of the goal of city government as moving from helping the poor to helping the middle classes.
Well, there were people who were concerned that the broken windows approach could be used as a justification for the criminalization of homelessness.
Well, and in fact, that's what happened, especially in Manhattan. I mean, the city basically used a variety of existing statutes to go out there and find excuses for arresting homeless people or driving them out of public spaces.
Well, New Yorkers were very embarrassed at the time to see all of these people sleeping in cardboard boxes around the city. And I think that they're probably happy that we don't see that anymore.
Well, not just embarrassed. They felt threatened. They felt their lives were disrupted. I mean, the concerns that people had about the mass visible homelessness were very real concerns, and something needed to be done about it. And I think that urban liberals did not have a clear approach. They said, well, let's develop some long-term solutions and let's just try to tolerate the problem. And Giuliani said, well, I don't know what the long-term solutions are, but I know what the immediate solution is, and that's we'll use the police.
So how effective was broken window style policing in reducing crime in the city?
Well, that's, of course, a huge discussion. I think that it was of minimal use in reducing crime. Crime dropped all over the country and Canada in places where they never heard of broken windows policing, and it dropped at a similar magnitude. So,
and why is that? I know we've talked about this in the past, and it's been suggested has something to do with demographics. The number of people between 18 and 25 dropped at a certain point, and then also crack cocaine use dropped as well for one reason or another.
I teach a seminar every year at Brooklyn College to our graduating sociology majors in which we explore this question, and I ask them to go out in their own neighborhoods and do research. And I think one of the reasons this has been such a successful class is that there's not an obvious answer. We don't really know the answer. We know what the answers are not. There's a lot of great work out there that shows it can't possibly just be the police. It can't possibly be the changes in abortion laws, that these things don't pan out, that it's a complex social phenomena that we're still trying to figure out.
But we haven't eliminated homelessness in New York. What have we done with those people?
In fact, homelessness is at record levels. There are more people today in the family shelter system in particular than ever in the city's modern history. And the number of single adults is pretty close to that record. So we have not made progress on the homelessness problem. Homelessness and hunger are at record levels in the city. What we did is we managed to break up the sources of visible disorder. So if you go to Midtown tonight and you walk around, you'll see a homeless person on almost every block in a cardboard box. What you won't see is congregations of homeless people. You won't see that, you know, 8 or 10 people around a trash can fire. You won't see them in the parks in large groups or taking over subway stations.
And they're not aggressive in New York as they are in San Francisco, where many people are horrified by panhandlers coming right up to them and in their face saying, give me money.
Yes, the situation is definitely worse in San Francisco, in part because San Francisco doesn't have much in the way of a shelter system. In New York, our state constitution was interpreted to guarantee people a right to basic emergency shelter. They don't have any such provision in San Francisco, so you have thousands of people waiting in line hoping to get a shelter bed who then get turned out onto the street or who have just given up. And it's sort of poison the environment in some ways, I think.
You don't include the Bloomberg administration in your book, but I'm curious about how you judge the way he's dealt with New York's homeless population.
Well, he has not relied on the same kinds of rhetorical attacks on the homeless, the kind of blaming the victim response, the kind of Manhattan Institute neoconservative turn. But his housing policies are really no better. And in fact, homelessness is much higher under the Bloomberg administration than it was in the Giuliani administration.
But hasn't he come up with a plan, he claims, will add living space for 1 million more New Yorkers?
Yes, but the whole nature of the homelessness problem is not a shortage of housing overall. It's a shortage of housing that's affordable by people who are working at the bottom of the economy or who are unable to get into the economy. And that's the mismatch that neither the Giuliani or previous administrations, much less the Bloomberg administration, have addressed.
Well, to some degree, I don't know how this works and how you work out something equitable. But right now, because there is a limited amount of housing in New York, neighborhoods that once were less expensive have become more expensive simply because people are moving in there desperate to find places to live.
Well, there needs to be an increase in the housing supply. I'm not sure that the mayor's estimates of 1 million new New Yorkers are going to pan out, but there's clearly a housing shortage. But that housing shortage is primarily at the bottom of the market. And the way the market is structured right now, it's not cost-effective for a private developer to come in and build that housing. So the government has to play a role in that.
A listener asks for us to clarify the meaning of the broken windows policy. I thought everybody knew it, but obviously that's not the case. So can you give us the brief explanation?
It was developed in the early 80s as a way to explain the connection between disorder and serious crime. And James Q. Wilson and George Kelling in an article in the Atlantic Monthly argued that when public spaces are left unregulated, they become the domain of people who will engage in disorderly behavior. And if that behavior is not regulated, it will become more serious criminal activity, and that this in turn can lead to the downfall of neighborhoods. So if we don't put a stop to aggressive panhandling and public urination, this will quickly turn into armed robbery and homicide.
And so if somebody jumps a turnstile, we arrest him, we prevent him from committing a more serious crime.
You know, that was a tactic that I think was fairly effective in establishing some changes in the subway. You know, it was a very tightly controlled space where they could do that. And they did find that if they stopped everyone who jumped the turnstile, a certain number of those people had illegal weapons, had warrants, and or basically were up to no good.
My guest is Alex S. Vitale, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College, the author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics. It's published by New York University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I get the feeling reading this book that you're disappointed in how New York residents you've called urban liberals have behaved over the past 50 years.
You know, it's not so much the residents. I sympathize with the residents. I live in this city. I saw what it was like to be panhandled on the way to the store, on the way to the subway, on the way to get money out of the ATM, to not be able to use your parks, to have filth in your doorway. And I think anyone who tries to paint someone who's angry about that as being unreasonable is not helping advance the debate. What I'm angry about is the way that our political leaders both contributed to this problem and failed to alleviate it because of the kinds of economic development and social policy strategies they pursued. So it's really not one of these books that, you know, blames people for becoming neoconservatives. It really looks at the weaknesses of urban liberalism as a political philosophy.
Haven't urban liberals historically favored rehabilitation over retribution?
They have. The problem is if they don't deal with some of the underlying market forces that are driving people to have these social problems in the first place, then a handful of rehabilitation programs is not going to cut it. You know, homelessness, for some people, yes, it's about deinstitutionalization, it's about drug problems, the crack epidemic, et cetera, but there have always been people with drinking problems, with personality problems. In the 50s and 60s, those people had a place to live, and it helped to stabilize them and keep their problems out of the rest of our faces.
And I remember during the rougher times when everything was in our face, a lot of people said, oh, I used to be a liberal, but no more, because those policies have failed.
And they did fail, and they, in some ways, because they weren't really liberal policies.
Well, what about the NIMBY factor in all of this? Is that something that we can pin on what you've called hollow liberals?
Yes, I think so. It's a kind of empty empowerment where we say we want neighborhoods to play some role in governing the city and in controlling their own neighborhoods. We set up community boards, community police precinct councils, neighborhood school boards, but then we don't give these institutions any power. So we ask them to make comments, and then the city goes ahead and does what it wants.
You also say that urban liberals have generally been unwilling to press for more public funding for low-income housing and better public schools. Why? Because they don't have faith that the money will be used effectively?
Well, we certainly want the money to be used effectively. I think they didn't push for it because they didn't have the money, because the money was being used to subsidize this sort of entrepreneurial global cities model of economic development. Whether you go back to the period leading up to the fiscal crisis or to the recession during the Dinkins administration, the city was broke while still spending hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars a year subsidizing real estate.
I just heard a news report that New York City is something like 25th most expensive city in the world, partly because of the weakness of the dollar. But that means that it's an attractive place to visit. On the other hand, we seem to be entering a period of diminished prosperity. People are losing their jobs. Funding is being cut to the police and the schools. Subway and bus fares are going to go up again. Do you think that we'll see an increase in quality of life crimes as a result?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. I mean, I think that we're on the brink of something similar to the fiscal crisis of the 70s. Hopefully I'm wrong about that, but it looks like the potential of a period of sustained stagflation, and because of the way the city and the state have organized their finances, basically relying on these bubbles to pay for everything, when those bubbles burst, they don't have a solid revenue floor on which to keep city services going at exactly when they're most, at the time when they're most needed. You know, I think raising subway fares in a time of an economic slowdown is an outrage, and it just shows what a poor financial footing these institutions have been placed on.
Well, what's the alternative? To subsidize them with our tax dollars?
Absolutely. I mean, no public transit system in the world is self-financed by user fees. They're all subsidized by governments. In other world-class cities, those subsidies are sufficient to run a world-class transit system. I mean, it's quite appalling when you travel around the rest of the world and you see just how much better many of these cities are in running their public transportation systems.
Around the country, in fact.
And even around the country.
I mean, liberal New York is not as liberal in this regard either.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
How prepared are we now as a city to deal with a new round of hard times?
Well, you know, we're still, in many ways, the richest city on the planet. It's not like there aren't resources here, but there's a question of distribution. You know, for the state, if we had the tax system in place today that we had before George Pataki came into office, we would have a multi-billion dollar state surplus. So this is a very recent created problem that the city and the state don't have adequate resources to run the basic infrastructure of the city.
But can it be turned around?
Well, it's a political.
Can David Paterson wind up changing things, or is he in too precarious a situation?
Well, you're right that it's a political question. It's not a technical question. The resources are there. The question is whether or not there's political will. I don't think the political will is there yet. You don't hear unions, public sector unions, calling for progressive taxation. You hear, you know, occasional the Fiscal Policy Institute or some others are doing a great job trying to point out how this would be done. the political will is not there yet.
And how dependent are we on decisions made in Albany? For example, today I read in the newspaper that a state legislator from Rochester is preventing the city from putting more cameras up to catch people who go through red lights. Now, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea is a whole other issue. But we've had similar problems. Mayor Bloomberg's plan to limit traffic in the middle of Manhattan was stopped not by the city council, but by people in Albany.
Well, we're very hamstrung. I mean, many of these things like the MTA and the Battery Park Authority, these authorities are state agencies. The City University of New York is a state agency. And we can't change the rent control laws without approval from the state. There are a lot of things we can't do. A lot of the taxation authority we have comes through the state. So it is a big problem.
I understand you're planning to travel to Korea to study policing there. Will it turn out to be very different than what we do in the United States?
Well, that is the question. I think one of the things that appealed to me about going to Korea is the fact that they—
We're talking about South Korea.
South Korea, to Seoul in particular, is that they've undergone a kind of fiscal liberalization in the last 15, 20 years of opening their markets, of bringing in outside investors, outside banks— trying to create themselves as a kind of global city. And what I'm curious to see is if similar dynamics have merged there. There's an increase in homelessness there. There's an increase in street crime. And so I want to see how the police are responding to that.
Alex S. Vitale's book, City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics, is published by New York University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.